Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, Americans disagree about what patriotism is. So what does it mean to you?
No, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all. And it's not happening for all right now. When there's significant change, and I feel like that flag represents what it's supposed to represent, and this country is representing people the way that it's supposed to, I'll stand.
You're proud of our country. You're proud of our history. And unlike the NFL, you always honor and cherish our great American flag.
While I don't condone the protest during our national anthem, this is America. If our country stands for anything, folks, what? It's freedom.
This issue is important, but there is a football game.
Make no mistake about what the Colin Kaepernick controversy was about. Who gets to own the ideal of American patriotism? And what if that patriotism includes criticism of America? That's patriotic too, isn't it? Today, a conversation of our changing views of patriotism in a world that's growing more nationalistic, something President Trump has been talking about recently, and an idea of patriotism that Americans can share. So as our guests join us to guide the conversation, I'd like you to give some thought to this. What's the ideal at the core of your own patriotism? Describe that to me. And I'd like to know whether your patriotism allows for clear-eyed criticism of America and who we are as Americans. Now, when I say that, I don't mean an individual politician or political figure. I mean, as a whole, does your patriotism allow for criticism of Americans as an identity, as a collective? Think about that. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Reid Galen, is chief strategist for the Serve America movement, and he joins us today from Park City, Utah. Hi, Reid. Good to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks for having me.
Khalil Mohammed is with us, a professor of history at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and he's with us today from South Orange, New Jersey. And Khalil, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Khalil, we've been mulling over this show for some time, and then we watched French President Macron raise these questions at the World War I ceremonies, and we thought it was a good opportunity to revive the idea. Now, Macron said that he believed the rising nationalism in developed nations is, quote, a betrayal of patriotism. I want to pull that apart. First, what do you think he's seeing in Europe that alarms him about nationalism and that he sees as a betrayal of patriotism?
Well, part of the core of liberal democracy is the fundamental notion that every individual has a right to participate fully in society. And the question of who belongs in these various nations has turned less on a notion of citizenship and liberal democracy and more on blood and soil, which has been the rallying cry of nationalists around the world. So the degree to which Britain should be for Anglo-Saxons, the degree to which Germany should be for Germans, America should be for white Christians who were the Anglicans and the settlers and the colonists who came a long time ago. For Macron and for others, that is the challenge of this moment and a retreat away from a notion of liberal democracy back to a notion of nationalism that shaped much of the world in the 19th century and into the early 20th century.
Reid, Khalil just used a phrase that I think is going to come up through the course of this conversation, which is who belongs. And I think that's where clashing ideas of patriotism you know, end up occurring, that intersection of, well, my patriotism looks like this and your patriotism isn't as important or valuable as mine is. Would you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. And that, you know, I mean, I think what we've lost more than anything, and maybe we never had, right, and or never had completely, was the idea of what's the American ideal or what's a collective American ethos.
Uh-huh.
And I think that for a long time, you know, we probably thought that's, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, we're the shining city on the hill. And many of the voices that I think Khalil probably spends a lot of time studying and speaking with probably didn't really have a voice in those places. Now there are more voices, there are more ways to make those voices heard. I think we also can't underestimate the fact that in the last 20 or 25 years, we've had massive economic, technological, societal change that I think many Americans are still coming to grips with, whether they live in Marietta, Ohio, where I was born, or in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is one of those things that, you know, what it means to be a patriot. But I think also one thing that is equally concerning about, you know, my patriotism is better than yours, is I saw a recent Ipsos survey that said that Republicans no longer see Democrats as, quote, real Americans and vice versa. And I think that's even as troubling as the patriot. And they're probably tied, I would guess. But the idea is that not only are you not patriotic, but you don't even get to qualify as having a voice or an opinion that's credible in my mind.
And Khalil, it's exactly why I've raised this question about loving your country and being clear-eyed about its flaws and about acting as a community of Americans to rectify those flaws. But I think what we're seeing turn up in the polls that Reid is talking about is if you criticize this country, you are not, by definition, exhibiting the kind of patriotism that we hold up as the example of patriotism.
Well, let me give an example that has been very much part of this moment. And for me, as a historian, these moments are not yesterday's news, but in fact, our generational moments, our decade moments. And so if you recall, when President Obama was elected in 2008, and certainly even his candidacy, the rallying cry of what became the Tea Party movement was a notion of channeling Thomas Jefferson's famous statement, "The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants," which turned into a political movement as a rejection of the office of the presidency.
Mm.
A rejection of a vision of America embodied by the majority of Americans who voted not once but twice for that Democratic president. Fast forward to 2016, we have a president who has identified with white nationalism, and now the very people who used a notion of revolutionary dissent against a tyrannical government now have taken the other side and have adopted whatever you want to call them, authoritarian, fascist regimes, to quell dissent, to consolidate that very government against dissent. So in some sense, there are pockets of America that simply use whatever historical arc framework to maintain a commitment to a vision of America that is much more parochial, that is racially white, and is xenophobic in attempts to close the borders to anyone who they deem unworthy of American citizenship.
Let's take some calls on this. If you've just tuned into the show, it's a conversation about patriotism. As I said at the beginning, we've been mulling this show idea over for some months, and then French President Macron gave a speech at the World War I ceremonies talking about how he sees nationalism as a betrayal of patriotism. And we thought it would be interesting to define with our guests and with you what patriotism is, how it allows for criticism and dissent, and where we are in this moment of American history and how we see the ideal of patriotism. To the phones, to Shauna in Northeast Minneapolis. Hey, Shauna. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Glad you called. Interested
Thank
in
you.
What you have to say.
Yeah. So to me, I think that patriotism is very similar to nationalism, and that it's okay to love your country, but patriotism amps it up to a point where it is my country is better than your country, and it's us versus them mentality. And to me, I think dissent is allowed in our country because of freedom, not because of patriotism. And I also don't like the whole dissent is patriotic. I don't need to legitimize my dissent with something.
Okay.
Like, it's just dissent.
This is excellent because it gets us to something I wanted to talk about. Reed, the I thought Macron's use of the word betrayal was interesting, that he sees nationalism as a betrayal of patriotism. I think there's plenty of people in the world and in this country who see them as pretty close together. And we heard how Shauna would define this. What do you think?
No, I think that's right. And I think we should say this, that remember that when, when it comes to the word nationalism or how it's used, and specifically by how it's used by President Trump, you know, those sorts of things are no accident. He knows that it will charge up his supporters, and maybe almost as important to him as he knows it'll make his opponents crazy. And so, you know, he understands very well how to push those buttons, and he's happy to do them on a regular basis. I think that, you know, nationalism, I think, is patriotism, with an angry and dangerous edge. Right.
Ah,
it's not only that
okay.
we're better than you, but that we're going to do something about it. Right. That we're going to engender whether or not it's a moral or racial superiority on others around us, whether or not that's within our own country or externally, which is usually how it's, I think, espoused. Patriotism, look, I think that this is one thing we should also remember, that a lot of the discussions we have are important, but they also are about 30% of the population, right? There is the 15% on the far left and the 15% on the far right who make the most noise. They say the craziest things, but they also participate the most in the political process. Therefore, their voices amplify. Those people in the middle, you know, we should not underestimate the idea that most Americans and most humans can hold two thoughts in their heads
I can
be a patriot. And I can understand why an NFL player kneels.
I gotcha.
Both of those things.
But yes, to acknowledge what you've said, and I believe most of the people engaging in and listening to this conversation, and we'll go back to listen to it on the podcast, are those people in the middle. But who are hearing these competing visions of patriotism and nationalism and you know, distilling their views about that. That's where I think this conversation fits in. What do you think?
Well, I wanted to...
No, I think you're right. Oh, go ahead. Let Khalil.
I wasn't sure that was for me or for Reed.
Khalil, go ahead.
Yeah, so I want to push back a little bit and maybe even clarify how I hear Macron's statement.
Sure.
So patriotism is more capacious in the sense that let's just... if you recall, last year's Super Bowl had a Ford F-150 commercial that featured a voiceover of Martin Luther King,
yeah.
which was a kind of way of the NFL trying to evoke Martin Luther King's vision of America, of a universal family of brotherhood, a beloved community. Of course, it was crass commercialism, nevertheless, but here was an evocation of a Dr. King as an American patriot, as a way of combining that tradition of the civil rights movement and this evolution of America to a multiracial democracy vis-a-vis the civil rights movement. Well, nationalism, both in its 19th century manifestations and in its 21st century reincarnation, it has to reject that because that version of King is one that would have us recognizing the human rights of immigrants in Central America,
mm-hmm.
one that would recognize that this is not a Christian nation where one's religious beliefs are a litmus test for whether one belongs or not, or that their loyalty oath for whether or not you get to participate in the NFL or not. And so that is a form of patriotism where everyone is included around the universals of which we claim to appreciate. Nationalism is a retreat away from that, which is precisely why we've been having a politics and a set of policy proposals to close the borders, to define entire categories of people and nations as less than or as dangerous or as unworthy of participation in American life.
Here's how President Trump defined nationalism. This is in the midterm campaign trail, and he was acknowledging that he is being labeled as a nationalist and embracing it. Listen.
You know what a globalist is, right? You know what a globalist is. A globalist is a person that wants the globe to do well, frankly, not caring about our country so much. And you know what? We can't have that. You know, they have a word. It sort of became old-fashioned. It's called a nationalist. And I say, really, we're not supposed to use that word. You know what I am? I'm a nationalist, okay?
President Trump on the midterm campaign trail there defining nationalism. He's also talked about patriotism, and that's the subject at the heart of our conversation today. What's the ideal at the core of what you think of as your own patriotism? I'd like you to describe that to us. And does your patriotism allow for clear-eyed criticism of America and who we are as Americans? 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Just as we were playing that sound from President Trump, a tweet showed up here from Hatley who says, I think there's a part of this conversation that is missing being a globalist. Trump denounced globalism recently. Can you be a patriot and a globalist? She says, I think so, especially when it comes to climate change and environmental issues that transcend borders. Khalil, take a swing at globalism and nationalism and patriotism.
Well, it's a great question. I try to make this as simple as possible. To be a patriot and a globalist would be to say, I love my country and my country has a responsibility to be part of the Paris Climate Agreement. Mm-hmm. My country has a responsibility to be a responsible contributor to the human rights of suffering of people in the world. My country has a responsibility to reduce its own contribution to global warming. Those are all ways of both celebrating your country and its role in a world that is interdependent. No matter how we cut it, it is fundamentally interdependent.
Reed, how would you so let me ask the question this way now, given what Khalil just said. Can you be someone who celebrates a kind of nationalism, and I know all the connotations that are attached to that word, but is also a globalist and also sees yourself as a patriot, because you have this ideal of shared aspirations along with the recognition that we as Americans often fail those aspirations. Can you be all of that?
I think it would be difficult only because if we're using the sort of historical context of what it means to be nationalist, you know, shared aspiration is not a part of that ideal or that ethos, right? In fact, it's sort of antithetical to it. I am a nationalist. My country is better. I am better than you. Therefore, my country is going to go do whatever it needs to do to be better than yours or to get the things we need, right? That's that, you know, and also, you know, tends to have a more, I don't want to call it autocratic, but certainly more centrally controlled government, centrally controlled media, reductions in free speech and dissent. So to me, a nationalist government is not only, dislikes the outside, but it wants to control the inside with whatever measures may be necessary. And so, yeah, I mean, look, aspirations are, I think, also couched in optimistic terms, right? If you want everyone to do better, regardless of where they come from, who they are, what they're trying to do, I don't know that that can fit into a nationalist ideal. Whereas if you're a patriot, you can say, I love this country and I want it to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if it's climate change or whatever the case might be, I think that's maybe that's a core piece, right? Maybe that's a macro thing. Patriotism in its best form, if there is one, is an optimistic viewpoint, and nationalism in its worst form is a very pessimistic and cynical viewpoint.
Right. Jacob says on Twitter, patriotism isn't blind admiration. It includes the responsibility to demand better of your country when it's lacking, to merge on in South Minneapolis. Merge on, I, I hear you're related to one of our guests, Khalil. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He's a cousin.
Yeah. I'm so glad you called.
That's right. Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
Thanks for having me. You know, I just wanted to say, so I appreciate the conversation. And I like what Khalil said about celebrating your national identity or being proud of where you're from. But I think to call it patriotism is something different. So I want to offer, you know, perspective from folks of color, you know, again, just to kind of double down on what Khalil was saying. And in 20 years, we'll be a majority brown, black country. And the majority of us have not been included in what it means to be a true American. We have been otherized for 400 years. So what Khalil talked about, how the Tea Party really diminished the office of the presidency, you could take anything that has been attached with black and see how it's been ruined. I mean, we could take food, chicken and watermelon. So for a people who has been treated like that, I mean, we could talk to Native American people and get similar perspectives, or Latino brothers and sisters, or people, you know, from any immigrant group who could also tell you that they have been otherized. And it's really hard to call yourself a patriot in a country that still day in and day out otherizes you. And even now we have a president who not just otherizes people, but he literally attacks certain groups. So, I would say that those are two different things, celebrating and honoring versus calling yourself a patriot.
Merjan, this is great, because this is kind of what I was getting at the beginning of the conversation, which is, why isn't, and just to use something that happened that I think a lot of people are familiar with, this Colin Kaepernick thing. Why, and Khalil and Reed, please weigh in on this. Why isn't Colin Kaepernick's demonstration of his disappointment with America's values on race every bit as patriotic and every bit as legitimate as other expressions of patriotism that, you know, maybe we're more familiar with? This is where I want to get at. We have a tendency to delegitimize expressions of patriotism. So, Reed, what would you say about that?
I mean, look, I think that, you know, Colin Kaepernick took a knee. I was going to say he took a stand, but that doesn't make sense. Maybe metaphorically, but not literally. And so I think that, and he had every right to do that. He has every right to do that, as do every player, every citizen, regardless of what their walk of life is. And so I think what you saw was, you know, the strike point. And remember, I think a lot of this stuff too is, as Khalil said, and the last caller, is much cultural. Is cultural,
yeah, right?
It is now. We are now in a place where you know, if it's the other, right, or if it's African Americans or Latinos or whatever group has been sort of systematically, you know, pushed aside, actively, you know, acted upon in a negative manner, those voices are now starting to come to the fore. And we are all, as a country, both those with their voices now being heard and those of us who are now first hearing those voices, we are now in a transitionary period where we all have to accept the fact that for a long time we were not, we might have called ourselves a multicultural society, but that was really a multicultural society, you know, through the eyes of, you know, Thursday night sitcoms with the white family sitting around their living, right? And so I think that, you know, you take the Colin Kaepernick thing. If Colin Kaepernick's actions make you stop watching the NFL, like, that says a lot more about you than it does about Colin Kaepernick.
What do you think, Khalil, on this idea of which expression of patriotism is acceptable? I think that's a lot of what we've been arguing about.
No, it's a great point, and it overlays precisely with the larger themes of what we've been talking about around the world, which is that people simply are not truly received as having a right to dissent. If citizenship has always been conditional on being grateful for your presence in America, and that's certainly been the refrain as a critique of Colin Kaepernick, if you don't like it here, if you don't like America, then why don't you leave? He's only the most
prominent of those who have faced that kind of exclusion and derision. But certainly we've read innumerable stories in newspapers over the last several years about random people on the street of indeterminate nationality and origin, Asian American, South Asian American, Native, saying if you actually challenge anything in this country, then you can leave. So Merjan's absolutely right. Reed's absolutely right. The fundamental character of America continues to be up for grabs as to whether or not this is fundamentally a white European descendant Christian nation. And no amount of polling and no amount of survey will ever get at the precise number of people who fundamentally hold that point of view
because
people are savvy enough to not admit to it. The ones who do admit to it are precisely the kind of people like Brian Kemp, who just won the gubernatorial race in Georgia by saying, I am a proud, politically incorrect conservative who ran commercials holding his guns to show the world that he's ready to use them, particularly against what he calls criminal illegals. So we have at least two Americas, and one happens to be winning by virtue of its president and by a significant number of political elected officials around this country.
And yet, Khalil, it's such a great example because I look at that and I look at, you know, some of the rhetoric from the 2016 campaign and the 2018 midterm campaign as evidence of, how should I say this, the threat that that worldview is under and how the people that represent that threat feel like the sands running through the hourglass. I don't know. You maybe you're like, why would they feel in any way threatened? But that's what I sense, back up against the wall in some way.
Well, that's certainly the most generous reading, and I will agree. I want to be as optimistic that this is the last dying gasp, but we've been hearing the last dying gasp for a long time. It's not as if the Republican Party, as we know it today, is somehow completely antithetical to the white nationalism that emerged in 2015 and 16. The Republican Party has long been a party that has stoked racial fears and racist scapegoating within both its formal electoral politics and its gerrymandering techniques. And it has played a lot of symbolic lip service to racial inclusivity, but it has failed time and time again to live up to an actual set of politics that would reflect that vision. And that Republican Party is not numerically dominant in this country, but remains politically dominant. And we've been living with this for 40 or 50 years. I worry that in a brown America, we will see the potential, and this is where I think vigilance is most important, and getting these definitions of patriotism and nationalism right, we could see the potential of a majority black and brown country run on the basis of a white minoritarian view of who the country's really for, or what the politics of the country should be.
Rita, I'd love to hear you speak to that since you're the chief strategist for the Serve America movement. And how do you see that vision that Khalil presents?
Right. Well, I mean, I would never be so arrogant as to believe that I will ever have a true understanding of what it means to be African-American, Latino, Asian. Like, I'm a white guy, right? And I live in Utah. While I try and strip all biases out of my thinking, like I live in a place that is, you know, fairly homogeneous. I think most Americans probably do, frankly, regardless of what ethnic background you come from. I think what's lost, I'd like to say, goes back to something that I said at the beginning, but I think has a lot of resonance with what Khalil just said, is that, you know, the American ideal used to be that if you work hard and you're dedicated, you can make a better life for you, yourself, your family, your children, whoever it might be, right? Your community. And I think that the number of people who are now coming to the fore, right, who for a long time, for decades maybe, didn't feel or weren't literally able to make that a reality, is shifting how we see things. And so, you know, look, no human being wakes up in the morning and says, gosh, I hope today is worse than yesterday, and I hope my kids have a worse future than I do, right? There are some fundamental, I think, truths to being human, which are we want to make ourselves better. We'd like to make our future, you know, our families better. We want to provide more opportunity. But that is something that, you know, has probably been taken for granted for, you know, maybe 200 years, maybe since the Constitution was written. And so I think now, you know, to Khalil's point, there are people, whether or not it's Colin Kaepernick or others, who are saying this is my country too. Mm-hmm. This is my viewpoint on it. And no, I'm not going to leave. I'm going to stay here and tell you what I think because this affects my community or my family or my personal well-being.
It's a conversation, if you've just gotten in on it, about the idea of patriotism and the fundamental character of America. And Reed Galen is with us. He's the chief strategist for the Serve America movement. Khalil Muhammad with us, professor of history at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And your reflections on this, describe what the ideal at the core of patriotism, of your patriotism is. And then I've been asking you and hearing from a lot of you on whether your patriotism allows for clear-eyed criticism of America, and then how we feel as the demography of America is changing. What are we seeing this wrestling of what a legitimate expression of patriotism is? How are we seeing what it means to be an American changing and how many Americans are deeply uncomfortable? That informs this question about the fundamental character of America. Love to hear you on this. 800-242-2828, wherever you are in the area here, and 651-227-6000 in the Metro and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. Just want to share a couple of these before we go to news. Amanda says, as a U.S. Army veteran, it's maddening when nationalists call dissent in the form of free speech and expression unpatriotic as disrespectful to veterans. Veterans are so often spoken for and used to advance nationalist political agendas. Here's another listener who says, I'm a war veteran. Criticism of our government is patriotic. How else are we going to improve ourselves as a people, person, and government? Back to the conversation now and to the phones to Suzanne in Excelsior. Suzanne, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. We have a lot of people on the line.
Oh, no worries. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. What do you want to say?
Well, you know, as your caller said earlier, our responsibility to the earth, you know, our utmost responsibility is our moral responsibility to the human race and to our earth. And in addition to that, you know, our pride and responsibility to any community that we're a part of. And one of the most important communities is our country. But then our utmost display of patriotism would be our love of country. And we have to hold our country responsible because of how much we love our country.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have our country held responsible to that whole human moral responsibility that we have. And we have to do something about it, you know, to show that patriotism, to show that love of country. We have to show dissent. We have to show criticism. Otherwise, we're not showing love of country. Otherwise, we're doing nothing and we're not being patriotic.
Yeah, Suzanne, you're kind of bringing me back to a point that Reed Galen made a little earlier about we used to have kind of a shared ethos and if you work hard, you'll get ahead. Khalil, I feel like we don't, maybe this is part of the problem, we don't have a common shared ideal of what it means to be an American and aspire to make this a better place. Do you?
Well, let me unpack the definition that Reed has offered us and work through. So most Americans, you know, like to think that being a patriot in some ways is celebrating all that's good in America,
mm-hmm,
that they express
mm-hmm.
this patriotism by celebrating the American dream.
Right.
But one person or one community's dream has often been another person or community's nightmare. I mean, so part of it is that you could line up every single American naturalized citizen, native born, and ask them if they believe that hard work and ambition are an important part of how they define success. And I guarantee you, you'll get 90% of people say that. The difference is that many people live in an America that by definition has distributed opportunity unevenly and based on racial categories. Mm-hmm. That is not just the history, that is our present. That is fundamentally the critique that inspires this conversation vis-a-vis Colin Kaepernick. If you're a young black person living in America and you encounter police officers, you are fundamentally treated differently, whether it ends in being shot as an unarmed person, being harassed as a motorer, or simply being made to feel unwelcome in a community. That is the very nature of the critique, which means that your America, your American dream, your pathway to mobility and opportunity is fundamentally distinct and different for no other reason than your race. And we're just talking about policing. We're not talking about education. We're not talking about labor markets. We're not talking about the broader contours of our political participation, where we know voter suppression has been going on over the past several years on the basis of making sure that people of color are least likely to vote. So it's not that everyone doesn't believe in the ethos that Reed described. It's that some communities have to fight against the actual reality that says that actually we all believe this thing, but everyone can't participate because someone's going to lose, or my community is going to have to give up something in order for your community to fully participate.
Rita, I want to add to what Khalil said in something that I was reading in The Times by Wesley Morris. And this excerpt, I think, speaks to what Khalil was just saying. For some, we learn being American is conditional on behaving like a grateful guest. And when black people speak about America, they're informed they don't actually have a seat at the grown-ups table and that they should be grateful to be around at all. So put that together with what Khalil was talking about. What do you come up with?
So, again, I think it goes back to, the experience of an individual and that individual's collective community, which is, if you were going to be born anywhere, would it be better to be born in the United States of America or born somewhere else? I don't know. But if I'm being born here, yes, this is probably as good as it can possibly be. If it's Khalil being born here, better than, the average alternative probably, but our paths immediately diverge, as I think he said. And so I think that, if America at its ideal is, I think, the platform of what we are talking about, which is if you are born here, a country that prides itself on allowing the individual to identify, and Khalil may be right. I think he probably is right in many respects, which is, if we are trying to attempt the pursuit of happiness, then it's everyone's individual definition of what that happiness is, right? Mm-hmm, within the bounds of sort of society and law and everything else. And so I think that we can't overlook the things that Khalil described. We also can't, we cannot and should not say if we're going to have a chalkboard on which to draw what the ideal is, the U.S. is probably as good a place as any, not to say that that at all means that it is in any realm perfect or isn't in need of great reform and great, progress on many fronts.
Aaron says on Twitter, patriotism is the ability to question the system in place, the ability to question our identities as Americans, to challenge the status quo, to promote change and further understanding without fear of losing our lives or voices. Khalil, it's occurred to me that I think everybody would, the way Aaron just laid that out, I think most Americans would want to believe that of ourselves. But what you and Reed have been talking about today is also an acknowledgement that this is a deeply visceral and emotional and implicit, I think, reaction, which is why it makes us, I think, uncomfortable, too, to be going through these questions about who's a patriot, what it is, and how we get to express it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But again, I think it's important to unpack a few things because we're caught with language that leads us into unclear ideas. And I just want to be specific.
Okay.
So the first thing is that individualism is the framework that has adhered to the kinds of myth-making in America and the American dream ethos that basically says as long as any individual has a shot, then that's all we're responsible for,
mm-hmm.
which denies mm-hmm. that systems were built in the first place to privilege an expansive notion of whiteness, first a certain kind of elite white in the colonial period. Later it became, it moved to non-property holding white men, and eventually women got involved, and eventually, so it has been expansive, and we've even defined Mexican immigrants as white and people of Middle Eastern descent as white, and we're struggling over like, wait, maybe we have too many white people, so I don't want to get too sidetracked by that, but the point being that as long as we're focused on individual opportunity, then America has no further obligation to make things right, or that the government has no further responsibility for addressing systemic disadvantage.
Got it.
But if we look at the UN report by Philip Austin, which was a global analysis of extreme poverty, the United States' extreme wealth disparity and poverty levels match up to other parts of the world, in which case America cannot boast, nor should our citizens boast, that simply being born here guarantees that you will have a better quality of life of someone in some other part of the world. And that has been an old strategy for essentially coming back to what Wes Lowery suggested in that piece, is that if you don't like it here, then go somewhere else. But, of course, the problem is that black people, native people, and most of the immigrants of Latino or Hispanic origin, including those in the Southwest, have been here longer than most white Americans. So whose country is it? Other than the fact that we know white supremacy as a set of policy choices from the 18th, 19th, and into the 20th century were designed to privilege everyone who was white rather than non-white.
Chris adds on Twitter, our geographic birthplace is luck of the draw. So patriotism has to be earned. To the phones to Andrew in South St. Paul. Hey, Andrew, hi.
Hi, I'd like to present a contrary point of view. I think, first of all, that Colin Kaepernick is incredibly courageous. He's putting his wealth on the line, his career on the line. But I frankly think it has very little to do with patriotism. As I think back to Martin Luther King, who I had the privilege to march with as a young man in Boston years ago, what he was doing was about social justice, as is Colin. What he was doing was about making things, straightening out problems in the country. But he didn't cast it in terms of patriotism. What I think brought patriotism into this particular discussion is the fact that Colin, I think ill-advisedly, chose a traditionally patriotic moment, namely listening to the national anthem, as the way to express his legitimate social justice protest. And frankly, I think it's the people who are uncomfortable with traditional expressions of patriotism who are most keen to see this be now termed the new kind of patriotism. It's not. It's social justice. It's absolutely needed. It's absolutely courageous. But let's not turn patriotism into a word that it simply isn't. That's my point.
Wow, Andrew, you've said a lot there, and a couple different points I wanted to take up with you. But let's hear from Reed and Khalil on this. Reed first on Andrew's Colin Kaepernick, courageous, not patriotic, the moment that he chose, and also how Martin Luther King expressed his idea of the fundamental character of America. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think as far as Kaepernick is concerned, the caller makes a good point about the moment at which Kaepernick chose to make his statement. But I think it was precisely because it was that moment that he made it.
Right.
If he had done it in the locker room, no one would have known it. If he had gone and done his post-game interview and discussed his his feelings about whether or not it was Ferguson or the relationship between African-Americans and too many police departments around this country, it would have been one more soundbite. He did that explicitly, because I'm assuming, of course, I haven't spoken with him, explicitly because it was at that moment. And of course, if you're going to take big risks, you know, whether or not it's to be a symbol or to take a stand, then, you know, you open yourself up to a great deal of criticism. But I assume that Colin Kaepernick understood that very well when he did it. And I'm not sure that we would be having this discussion today if he had not done what he did, where and when he did it.
Khalil, I'm also interested in what you heard in the way Andrew described what Martin Luther King's expression of Andrew said that he didn't believe that King was expressing a version of patriotism.
Well, I wasn't entirely clear, but I will say what I think is worthy of response to. So we have to keep in mind that dissent can take the form of channeling the best ideals and holding the contemporary leadership to remind it of what it's capable of, which is really the thrust of what King's approach was for the 10 years leading to the 1965 Voting Rights Act. In other words, King, like Frederick Douglass in the 1850s, and I, you know, will just remind you that in the midst of slavery, Frederick Douglass said that the founding fathers had gotten it right, that America's fundamental constitutional principles of liberty and freedom and recognition of individuals as sacrosanct and its Christian values, of which he quoted from the Bible, should be the basis for that generation of slaveholders to change the error of their ways. And in many ways, that was what King tried to evoke in an effort to change the nature of racism 100 years later in the context of the Civil Rights Movement. And yes, he won those legislative values, changes. But he lost subsequently in the 2 years from that period when he began to critique American foreign policy in Vietnam, when he began to focus on economic inequality and the nature of racism. He was branded a communist and a traitor to the United States. And in that sense, he became much more like Colin Kaepernick in his willingness to choose a different form of dissent, to then challenge America. America, what are you really? Are you really the America of the Constitution? Are you really the America of the Bible? Or are you fundamentally committed to racism? And in that sense, one last point about Colin Kaepernick did not consent to having to bow down or put his hand over his heart or stand up to the American flag at work. He is an employee of the National Football League. I would not want to work for an employer who demanded that I stand for the Pledge of Allegiance before I can start my workday.
And
that is the fundamental issue that compelled him to say, well, wait a minute, I have a problem with my country right now.
Right.
But because I'm at work and now everyone on a grand stage, millions of people are asking me now to support my country right now in this way, that's what compelled him to kneel, not because he chose the wrong venue.
I wanted to ask you, too, we've only got a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you both whether you think the debate that ensued from the Kaepernick activism and now the way Macron has kind of brought this back, not that we've settled anything, has anything been clarified? Or is it the usual way that America approaches these really difficult, complicated issues? Reed, did any clarity emerge from this?
I don't believe so, but clarity is subjective, probably for most people, and not often quick in coming. So I don't know that we should expect to have found it by now. I think that it is important, though, that the dialogue continue. We have a lot of work to do in this country, from sea to shining sea. And whether or not it is income inequality, regardless, again, of racial, ethnic background, we do have a zip code lottery, as one of your callers noted, that again cuts across all ethnicities and demography. So I think there is a lot of work to be done. But the scary part to me is when the talking stops, what comes after that? So look, these are tough times. These are sticky issues. As Khalil said, most of this goes back to the first time, you know, a pilgrim stepped off the boat at Plymouth Rock. And so the idea that we would have completed this evolution, you know, even since 1965 and in the civil rights movement then, I think is probably far-fetched. But I think the talking and understanding is hugely important. And then taking, you know, both social, civil, and political action to really start to move this country, you know, to the place that, you know, it becomes a more perfect union.
Reed and Khalil, thanks much.
Thank you very much.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.